Neck throughs, guitars, they're like a guy that you won't have a beer with you.
I want to hear what's pushing the notes.
Freddie King and B.B. King, Albert King, and let's not forget Burger King.
I don't want to blow my knuckle out.
Stainless steel is the work of the devil.
These go to 11.
From the East Amplification Tone Labs in Baltimore, Maryland, it's the Amps and Axes Show with your hosts, Jeff the Godfather of Low Wattage Amps Bober and Mick Marcellino.
Well, good day to you, Mr. Bober.
Good day to you, Mr. Marcellino.
Oh, hey, our fans, we can't thank you guys enough. You are spreading the word.
That's right. And thank you so much. We couldn't do it without you, man.
Yeah, and please make sure that when you tell somebody about it, that you tell them that you heard it here first.
That's right, because you probably did.
Hopefully.
Yep, hopefully. So we're going to take a quick break, pause for the cause, and we're going to come back with our guest of the week, a recurring guest for us, Miss the one and only Miss Gretchen Men.
Hey, this is Heber from Kickin' Valentina, and you're listening to Amp and Axis. Now turn that shit up loud.
Hi there, this is Matt Wakeling, host of the Guitar Speak podcast, a weekly show produced in Sydney, Australia, interviewing leading guitarists, luthiers and gear builders from Australia and all around the world. We're into all sorts of styles, all sorts of gear. So if you love the guitar, why not look us up on iTunes or Stitcher and join thousands of listeners around the world who tune in to the Guitar Speak podcast.
Okay, and we are back as promised with our guest of the week, the recurring guest, the one and only Miss Gretchen Men. Gretchen, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Doing great. Doing great. Glad to have you back on.
I am so happy to be back on. You guys were so much fun last time.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has.
It doesn't seem like it because we do this every week.
Yeah.
But then when you go back in the episodes, you go, well, that was like 100 episodes ago.
That's a lot of scrolling.
Wow, it is a lot of scrolling.
Well, not really. All you have to do is go to our front page, and it's all right there.
Yeah, so. That's true. Mick fixed it.
Yeah, cool.
All the episodes are down below now, so I don't get many complaints now.
Cool.
Yeah, so that we haven't talked, but since that time, a new album has come out.
Exactly.
That's right.
And that's why Gretchen's back on.
And we don't want to confuse it with... All Hope Is Gone by Slipknot.
So this is Abandon All Hope, right?
That's right. Yes.
Abandon All Hope.
So how long does this take you?
A really long time. I started composing it almost right after Hail Souls came out. Hail Souls came out at the end of July of 2011, and then Michael Melinda and I met in December of 2011. Actually, it's funny, I still have the sheet he gave me, and it's 5 years to the date of when we did the pre-release party. So it was December 8th, 2011. We had the first meeting where he pitched the idea to me. And I didn't really know Mike at that time. In fact, I knew him only slightly more than the story he told you guys about me sending him a pissy email, which of course I remember differently. But we knew each other a little bit more through Jude Gold, who you guys also know.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I really didn't know what to expect in our first meeting. I kind of had braced myself for the lecture I get a lot, which is, why don't you sing and why don't you write more pop-friendly music and stuff like that. And I always try to be open and at the same time, you know, keep a sense of integrity of who I am as a musician and who I'm striving to be and all of that, while at the same time being open to suggestion and trying to, you know, hear people out.
Mm-hmm.
But then he busts out this sheet that says, Dante's Inferno, a journey in 11 different musical moods. And I was like, blown away. It could not have been more up my alley. So there was no negotiating. There was no deliberating. It was like, yes, I'm 100% on board. I will anything creatively that I might have had going, like, this will be the top priority. So it was about, to answer your question, it was a few years in composing. 1 year, it was particularly bad stuff going on in my life personally, so I wasn't all that productive. So I would say probably a good 3 years of composing, and then another year of recording and, like, production.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and the yeah, the composing part
is insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, a lot of that composition kind of just gets done in your head, right?
I wish I could say yes. I try to compose as much as possible away from the instrument, that I don't have. I'm working to get a better internal ear that allows me to really do kind of what you were saying. The thing that everybody attributes to, you know, composers like Mozart, you know, just transcribing directly from his muses to the page. And no, I can't do that. But I do I do concept things away from the instrument a lot. I do come up with melodies. I do have ideas for harmonic progressions or for arrangement ideas. And I try to do as much of that as possible away from the instrument, so that I'm neither like writing to showcase nor to avoid anything in my technical abilities. I'm trying to write as a composer, not as a guitar player.
Okay.
And that is covered a lot in this, because there's a couple songs that I really don't even hear much guitar, if any.
Yeah, there's a couple that don't have any guitar.
Yeah, and now I did listen. I cheated a little bit. So I listened to Jude Gold's podcast, No Guitar Safe, when you were on there, which, by the way, the first 10 minutes was the funniest thing ever, because you started spouting lyrics from Two Live Crew, which was pretty different.
You know what? I feel like the people who know me really well aren't surprised at all. The people who don't know me at all, it's not all that, like, scandalous, but it's the people who kind of know me in my polite, like, you know, I try not to offend anybody. I felt like those are the ones that needed an apology in advance. Like, the ones who are like, oh, you've been like a good role model to my daughter or something like that. I'm like, okay, then just go ahead and skip that first 10 minutes.
Well, it starts off, you're reciting Shakespeare, right?
Yeah, well, what it is I'm a guitar player. When somebody says, let's do a mic check, I don't know what to say. Check, check, check. I do that for like 2 seconds, and then I feel like such an idiot. And since Jude and I are good friends and we totally have a connection of literature, he's kind of egging me on. And so I start doing the, like, to be or not to be, that is the question. And I could tell that he's like, yeah, 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 like, thinking that I'd know just that much of it. And I'm like, uh-uh. So he's kind of egging me on, and it's sort of like this challenge. And I'm like, no, dude, I know the whole thing. And I didn't think he was going to keep it in. Like, I thought, you know, we were just, the line between when the interview was actually starting and when we were just kind of like just goofing off became unclear. And I actually think that it was really supposed to be a mic check. But then, you know, when he listened to it back afterwards, he did write to me and he's like, can I please keep this in? And I was like, are you kidding? No way. Like, I go from sounding like totally like just like the most geeky like jerk to like completely offensive to so many people. And he's like, I'm sorry, it's too funny, I'm keeping it in. I'm like, all right, well,
no way, sorry, it's already produced.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
I'd ask, but your answer doesn't matter.
I will leave it as that anybody can go over and listen to Jude's podcast and hear this, and you will be you'll be rolling on the floor, because I mean, she goes straight from Shakespeare to Two Live Crew, doesn't miss a beat and or a word. And let me tell you, a little bit different than Shakespeare.
It's the G version.
It's, you know, I like all of the different spectrum of the English language. I know lots of words.
Some good, some better.
And, yeah, exactly.
Now the best part of colorful. That whole thing was the grammar correction. That you used, because you go, well, he's not even saying that right. Why would you even say that?
Well, yeah, I think that's why it stuck with Jude. Is he, when we were first, you know, becoming friends, he thought I was like, I don't know, I guess a lot of people maybe think I'm a lot more uptight than I am, and so he thought when he had played, because he played the solo, the whole point, I don't know if that came about in his podcast or if it was clear, is that he played the solo on that song. You know, there's a part at the end that says, you know, like, go get him, guitar man, or something like that. That's the part I don't remember because I was too busy criticizing the other lyrics. but then Jude, of course, takes this ripping guitar solo, and he had sent it to me saying, like, hey, just listen to the guitar solo. Don't listen to the other stuff. It's super offensive. Like,
wow.
So I listened to it, and I agreed that it was offensive, but for totally different reasons from the reasons he thought I would. You know, just not from the content, but the quality.
No, the improper grammar was offensive.
Right. Well, and the, you know, and the inconsistent character too. He wasn't believable.
How about that guitar solo?
Yeah, but the guitar solo is really good.
Wow.
Well, so totally off track.
Another podcast
awesome.
Starting out.
So I wanted to, I kind of guess, I listened to the album and I went through and I kind of wrote some notes down because I wanted to kind of go song by song just to get where your perspective is or was what you were thinking at that time. Yeah. And then like,
what the hell was I thinking?
And then what I hear, because some of this, I'm like, because I can't, I just can't even comprehend how you did some of these, how you scored this stuff out. I just don't even, I'm like, okay, what is the tempo? Where's the beat of this? I don't have a, because there's a couple songs that are, there's nothing but strings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like,
I mean, the first four or so are just like very, very,
yeah,
like almost traditional classical type of pieces.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, was it Lake of Ice and Mist?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, that's it. It's just and it's a quartet, right?
It's a string quartet. They're not on every piece. Some of them have just the first violinist, Glauco Bertanian, but a number of them have string quartet, yes.
And that was all done in Italy, right?
That's right, yeah.
What was that studio like? I mean, they obviously don't record your normal bands because recording strings is completely different, right?
It is. And the reason I did it in Italy was specifically to record at that studio with those musicians. That's where Daniele Gottardo did the orchestral instruments for his album. And the engineer, Ugo Bozzoni, he is the guy who had experience blending modern instruments with classical instruments. So it's kind of his specialty. So,
well, it's amazing because the sound is like, it's huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, in a digital world, especially with strings, I guess it's a little bit tougher to get that, you know, that feel back. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to do things. Unlike 2-inch tape, the tape takes that a little bit better. You know, yeah, you can kind of separate
and harmonics and things like that.
Yeah, it's just it stays in an analog format to the tape.
Right.
Where when you go to that digital and it starts becoming ones and zeros, the lines don't flow as well. So you have to do some things. And obviously, whoever that engineer is did very well because I was listening to it and it sounded very big.
Good. Yeah. Well, and some of that has to do with, we did bounce it to tape. So even though it was recorded digitally, end up, and I did this actually with Hail Souls as well. I like the sound usually of the bounce to tape, you know, for exactly the reasons you guys mentioned. Okay. And Ugo Bozzoni, and his studio is called New Frontiers Recording Studio in Rovigo, Italy. He had a lot to do with it. Daniele had a lot to do with it, too. He helped a huge amount with the artistic production, you know, having done his album, which is actually the whole reason we met to begin with, as a mutual friend who knew what he was working on with Non Temperato and what I was working on with this, was like, hey, you guys are like two of the only guitar players I know who are seriously geeky about composition and orchestration. And so that's how he kind of got enlisted. Is actually, first I had produced some vocal tracks of my sister Kirsten for his album Non Temperato, and then when I was trying to figure out what to do for strings for my album, and he had been telling me about this amazing string quartet he had worked with, is when I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe he can do that for me in Italy. And so we did three songs initially just with Glauco, and they were so good that I was like, you know what, I'm coming out there. Not because they weren't fantastic to begin with, but because when I crunched the numbers, it was actually cheaper for me to fly to Italy and do it there.
Yeah, they just because four people to come this way, I guess. Yeah,
Well, not only that, but just it's like the Bay Area. Are you kidding me? This place is so unbelievably expensive. Whereas in Italy, you can get like a world-class string quartet for less probably than the price of a single comparable musician for the same amount of time here.
Wow.
So
I believe that.
It was cheaper. It was actually just cheaper.
So
Rise is another adventure.
Rise is another song too, right? That you that is all strings.
Actually, that was an important piece in a sense, because that was the one that Glauco played. And after he played it, he came out of the studio and he speaks some English, but it's kind of broken. And my Italian's not good at all, but I do fragmented Italian. But he was able to convey, he pointed to especially the second page of it, and he was like, "This is really well written." And I was, of course, like so flattered. And then he said, "I want you to write something for my string quartet." Well, did I need to be asked twice?
Wow.
No. So I came home and I reimagined some stuff for the string quartet, and then I went back and thought about which pieces I would want string quartet on, and went back and did.
Nice.
Well, now what I got from most of this, minus the guitar parts, the electric guitar parts, because you do some classical stuff in there too, and we have to talk about that guitar. But what I got from it is that you hear certain pieces that are written by these modern day musicians that write in this classical style, and you go, feels like something that was written this year. You know what I mean? Like, it has that feel. This really felt like, a 17th century piece. You know, it has that feel to it. That it doesn't come across as, oh, look, I'm trying to write this modern piece of classical music. Mm. It just has this very genuine feel to it. Mm-hmm. Not, something that's being like a new world music, per se. Because, you know, there's that new world stuff has kind of got that feel, and it's heavily strings and stuff like that. But it still has this kind of...
Yeah, this is much more traditional.
Yeah, Without
Gretchen must be reincarnated or something.
Exactly. Because the dynamics are what blows my mind away, because it does have that ebb and flow that a lot of classical music does, where it builds and then it goes down and then it comes back. And, you know, and that's what I was feeling off of this thing.
It's orally painting a picture.
Yes.
You know?
And then some of it is crazy rock music.
Which I thoroughly enjoyed.
yeah. And I felt like I could hear definitely some Steve Morse, Dixie Dregs kind of sound stuff, bits and pieces of that. Even a little Led Zeppelin, like on the first song. Because that Shadows has that kind of Zeppelin feel thing going on. And I just, that's what I hear. Steve is like who's hero isn't Steve Morse?
Oh, Steve Morse. I know. My God.
You know, it's Steve Morse.
I mean, to be
mentioned in the same sentence is awesome.
Right. yeah, that's pretty awesome.
So that's what I got from it. And some of it was like, I was like, man, I wonder if she was having a dark time. 'Cause you know.
It's funny. It's funny because the dark time did exist within it, but when I started the album, it wasn't.
Wow.
And I'm not so much of a method composer that I would have engineered a dark time in my life to coincide with it, so that the music would be more authentically dark. It just so happened to be that way.
Wow.
But I did study. I did study music in college. And I have continued to study with a composition teacher and then more recently with an orchestration teacher. And, you know, I really am pretty geeky. Like, I really do, you know, I say people do like crossword puzzles and Sudoku, and I do counterpoint, you know, even if it's just kind of a fun little mind game, you know, especially if you're doing the 16th century counterpoint, the Palestrina style stuff that's like so unbelievably restrictive that you're like, I think there's only one way to harmonize this cantus firmus and actually not be breaking any rules or regulations of counterpoint. You know, so I don't want to say that I approached the album that mathematically. I didn't. If there's anything that I really loved about the album was the idea of writing to a concept, because I think the way I'd always approached music was a little bit more free, which I don't mean now to have that be a negative, anything negative on a concept, but I would write something because I would find it entertaining or amusing or beautiful or intriguing for some reason. And when you have a concept like, okay, write something that sounds like violence, write something that sounds like treachery or lake of ice or, you know, a hellhound. It kind of doesn't matter what I think might be a cool riff or a cool lick or a nice melody. If it doesn't serve the concept, then I don't use it. And so what it did is it pushed me into totally different creative areas. Limbo is the one that I've often mentioned. It's like to take away the most fundamental thing about Western music, like tension and release, you know, and to try to create a sense of limbo, meaning that of never resolving, and yet at the same time to make it sound like a complete piece of music while just moving from one area of tension to another flavor of tension. That blew my mind trying to do that. Like, I remember just sitting down and being like, what am I going to do here? How do I write something that sounds like that?
Is that the one that's kind of transitional? It's very short and...
No, that's Howard Swoon, I think you're thinking. Limbo is, I think, it's the second
track
piece.
Track two, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it does have a lot of tension in it. Mm. It's the notes are very... You're like listening to it, it's like almost anxiety.
Yeah.
It really puts you there.
And well, that's... Cool. Yeah, I guess
I mean,
that would
everything,
be a good... vision,
yeah.
A musical vision of Limbo, like if it brings anxiety to the way you feel it, you know, that's like
right.
Wow, yeah,
and I guess that's another thing too, is that classical music a lot of times or classically written type pieces, they create moods very easily because you know when you have you know several instruments playing off of each other that way, it really does. It isn't like. Yeah, you could listen to aforementioned Slipknot, and you're going to be angry because there's a guy screaming at you. And you know when people are screaming at you, it kind of makes
the emotion in slightly different way.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
The thing about a Slipknot song is every song is a guy screaming at you.
Right.
So, but to intertwine these different emotions within even the same songs, that's the part. See, yeah, you are a geek. Because, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but I just can't
it's
even.
Okay, it's true.
Being this metal moron that I am, I hear this stuff and I go, my brain actually hurts. And it's not because it's not easy to listen to. This is really, really good music.
Yes.
But it hurts me because I'm going, I don't understand how she wrote this.
Right. How? Right.
Like,
right.
I'm like trying to think like her, and I'm going, I've had...
Don't try that, Nick.
I've had multiple conversations with Gretchen off of the air. Mm. And I'm like, she must think I'm a Neanderthal. That's all I can think of.
No,
I'm like,
no.
I'm a 50-year-old man. I feel like I'm 2 inches tall standing next to Gretchen when we have conversations because I'm going, her brain is 12 steps ahead of me. Mm-hmm. She has...
On a bad day.
She has probably... she's probably rewritten every bad sentence I've said.
No! Oh, no. See, I shouldn't have even talked about Two Life Crew.
But see, that's the part that gets me because when I hear this music, I go, this is like a level that 90% of the people out there that play can't even comprehend. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, guys that actually are...
Well, they you know, and maybe half of them can comprehend it on somewhat of a musical level, whatever level or degree that is.
I think you're giving more credit to a lot of guys.
Okay, well, a few that I know, maybe.
Yeah.
But in order to compose it, it's a whole different thing.
That's
you can understand it, but it's
game.
The composition of it that's
yeah, that's the mind-blowing
awesome.
Part to
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
Because it's like you sit down with pen and paper, and now I heard you create these MIDI tracks, right? Is that how you do it?
Well, what I do is I do some with pen and paper, but once you do that, then you just end up having to input it into some sort of scoring program. So I use a program called Sibelius, and so it looks like a score, and I input the notes onto the score. Mm-hmm. And then they have like MIDI instruments, so you can actually hear your score back in real time. Oh, because... Cool. My internal ear is not so developed that I can just work out, you know, really good counterpoint in my brain between multiple instruments and just, you know, then transcribe it onto the page. I'm not there yet. I don't know if I ever will be there. But when I can hear things, I can slow it down. I can hear it in real time. I can put the notes on the page in that way. I do find it more comfortable to see a score. I know a lot of people just use like what do they call it, like the piano roll, like in Logic. I think a lot of pretty well-known composers actually do that. I don't remember if it was Danny Elfman or I'm not gonna talk about something I don't know, but I know a lot of people do use that. I just happen to, and maybe this is just starting on classical guitar, maybe it's the fact that I do like to study scores. Mm-hmm. I find it easier just to look at the score, so I do it that way. But then I do like the feature that it allows me to hear it played back, you know, and then I can also select different groups of instruments. Like I can hear just the string quartet, or I can just say, how is this cello sitting with the viola, or how are just the guitar and first violin sounding together? So
that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Now,
technology wise, that's
oh yeah,
pretty
well,
awesome.
Oh, it's great.
Forget about it now,
highly
right?
recommend Sibelius for anybody doing really anything compositional. And even if not, I actually was using it for Hail Souls, which, you know, I was interested in composition at that point, but it's really handy even just for doing charts, you know, to mm-hmm. hand to musicians, even if you're not writing out, you know, a full, you know, composed piece of music for them, even if you're just like, here, this many measures of A and then this many measures of F sharp or whatever.
Yeah, and our good buddy up north, Mr.
Jason Sedidas,
yes, he uses Cubase, and he writes out all of the parts.
Is that what he writes out?
Yeah, he does that too, which, and he writes out crazy drum parts for Marco Miniman.
Mm-hmm.
And,
and
Marco just usually plays it the way that he writes it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, you wrote that one click at a time with a mouse, and he's like, yeah. And then I just go home and want to punch the screen.
Right.
So my question, we did talk to Daniela, but he didn't understand us too well because his English was very broken at the time.
Yeah.
How did he get from being this Ace Frehley nut to writing compositions like what we hear on your album? I mean, I know he didn't write that stuff, but
yeah.
He has that capability, right?
Right. Well, if you've heard Non Temperato, you'll definitely. His stuff's really deeply compositional, and the new stuff he's been working on too, I've been hearing it. It's amazing. I mean, my gosh, the amount of growth between his first album and second album will be at minimum the same amount between his second and what will be this next one, I'm sure. I think a lot of it, you know, so it kind of ties in with some of the stuff you were saying before, which, by the way, thank you so much. It's very kind words. But well, like with anything, it's it's there is a skill set. It's not like a big nebulous mystery that somehow some people just can write notes on a page that, you know, composition, like anything, there's a huge amount of craft to it. And that is craft that is available to be studied in books and with teachers and through seeing what other people have done and do. And with anything, you know, it's not like I wish I had 6 hours a day just to study composition. I don't, but I allocate a certain amount of time every day to it. And while that does take away from guitar time, it to me is just, it's something I've always been interested in and always wanted to do. And I kind of feel like, well, even if it means that I'm taking that time away from guitar, maybe it means the stuff that I then will ultimately still be playing on guitar is something that I believe in more if I hadn't been studying this. So with Daniele, you know, going from Ace Frehley, I think very quickly he got into Yngwie Malmsteen and some of the people who leaned more in that compositional direction. And then very quickly he started studying harmony. I know he was really into Schoenberg's Theory of Harmony textbook and became interested in composing that way. And, you know, he also does a lot of score study. And
that makes sense now, because
his knowledge about harmony is insane. Like, I've never met anybody with a deeper knowledge of harmony.
Wow.
Huh. That's why Steve Vai's a fan of his.
Yeah.
Because Steve, Steve is a harmony monster. I've heard he has been in open jams with guys, and the guy will be playing something, and there he is just doing the harmony.
The harmony.
And it's kind of off of the cuff, and the people that are playing the, you know, what they were playing, just like just
the melody line or something, like or the solo part.
Yeah. What planet is this human from?
Yeah.
Because he just does it like that. And I've read that, and I'm sure you'll get there, that Steve has said that a lot of times when he writes his music, it's just he just writes it. He doesn't play it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is in his head, and he writes
writes it out.
And that was all due to all of the transcribing that he did for Zappa to be in his band.
Right.
And Zappa just pretty much, he treated him like crap, but it was to make him, he knew he was
pushed
good.
His limits. He really pushed his limits.
And he was too young to be in that band because of the content.
Mm-hmm.
So he pushed him to no end. And when he saw that Steve did it, then he was like, oh, you got the job. And but then he had literally, I think, 2.5 years of all of his music composed, you know, transcribed.
Transcribed, yeah.
And that he said after that, it was like when he wanted to write something, he didn't even pick up the guitar. He just wrote it.
Yeah. And that is something that I'm so working on. But, you know, that's another skill that takes time and practice.
Yeah.
Right.
And I guess the part, the really good part is you're sort of like, and I'm going to do this weird comparison here, but it's something that I know. A friend of mine joined the Marines, and he had never shot a gun before he'd ever joined the Marines. Well, he went through boot camp, and he was a sharpshooter, like one of those guys wearing the ghillie suit, you know, that can crawl around and be right beside you. And I said, you know, you never shot a gun. He goes, well, the problem is that all the guys that learned from their dads, they didn't have the proper skill set, right? So you really didn't dabble in guitar until you went to college, right? And then it was all classical from that point.
Right.
When you so it kind of set that precedence.
Learned properly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like right out of the gate, you were learning the correct way, quote unquote. Although B.B. King would probably argue, but you know what I mean.
And, I love B.B. King.
and I guess that's why it you're where you are today.
Right.
And
right.
I'm sitting behind this microphone.
You're a great guitar player.
That makes two of us. We went over like the amount of time that this took from conception to, you know, realization, but surely that wasn't the only thing that you were doing for all those years. You know,
what have
you been involved in that's been really fun or noteworthy? And, you know, you got to have some fun too, instead of composing 6 hours.
Oh yeah. The album would have been done a lot quicker if I didn't have other stuff to do. Zapparella, I play with that band. We did like a national tour in the time that I was working on the album. you know, so actually a lot of times in Zeppelin, on Zeppelin van drives, I'll be in the back, like writing stuff on my computer. And truly, you know, or reading scores or whatever. So I try to do as much as I can. And actually, you know, it is fun. Like I love doing that, but I also love playing Led Zeppelin. And I love, I think maybe before I hadn't done the Django Reinhardt thing that I did a cover of Minor Swing and released it actually in part because I always try to carve out some just pure musical recreational time, something that isn't, it's so easy once you're playing professionally to have all of your practice be dictated by whatever your upcoming obligations are instead of, hey, what do I want to do today? And even if you want to do all the things that you've agreed to do, there's sometimes this lack of spontaneity when you pick up your instrument because you feel like you have your whole day carved out for you based on your obligations. And sometimes that's still the case. There's definitely the last couple of weeks I have not had really any recreational time on my instrument. But I do try to, as much as possible, have at least a little bit of time to just totally have fun. And it occurred to me last year, I guess, that Django Reinhardt was like my favorite guitar player and I didn't know a single lick of his. Not only did I not know a single lick, I wouldn't have even been able to pretend to do like, hey, this kind of sounds like a Django lick. Or if I did, it would have been just something so unbelievably boneheaded that, you know, it wouldn't have even convinced me. So I thought,
think you're
hey,
very
you know,
hard
maybe. So I thought maybe I'll learn a couple of his licks. So I turned on Minor Swing and I like learned like the little opening a few licks. And then I'm like, I'm gonna learn that whole chorus. Just the first chorus. And so I learned it and then one thing led to another and then I learned the whole thing. Including the violin part for the Stephen Grappelli solo because that was really cool too. I kind of couldn't stop myself, and because I was transcribing it by ear, by the time I learned it all, I had it memorized as well. So then that's when I thought, God, I've been working on this album for so long and I haven't released anything new. Maybe I'll just record this and release it to, you know, to the general public. And even though I'm sure that some gypsy jazz purists will get their feathers ruffled, like I'm not trying, you know, it's not about, it's music. Like it's not going to hurt anybody. And it's also not about trying to pretend to be or to please the purists, but more to share with or to introduce maybe some people who don't know Django. And in fact, somebody wrote to me the other day saying they never knew of Django until I did the cover. And I'm like, that blew my mind. But great, now they get to know Django. So I ended up doing this cover of that, which was really, really fun to do.
And there's a YouTube video out there.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. It's just Minor Swing. And I play the Django part on my Steven Strom Eros guitar. That's this gorgeous acoustic guitar. And then the Stephen Grappelli violin part on my Music Man Silhouette.
So nice. But that's that acoustic, and it's a steel string acoustic, correct?
It is, except for the recording for the video, I went and I found like gypsy jazz strings that so they're like a nylon core. And I put those on it. I actually still have it on there. So
wow.
It is not a gypsy approved style of instrument. It wasn't meant to be one. It wasn't built to be one. When I told Steven Strom I was gonna be recording some Django on it, he was kinda like, really? I'm like, no, it sounds good. It sounds good. I'll, you know, it doesn't sound like authentic gypsy jazz, but I'm not an authentic gypsy jazz player. I'm pretty sure if Django picked up my guitar, it would sound like authentic gypsy jazz. So I try not to do the blame the gear thing. It's a wonderful instrument. And actually the whole reason, or a huge part of the reason I recorded it, was to showcase that instrument. I think Steven's stuff is beautiful and I thought it would actually be a more compelling endorsement of the stuff than doing some sort of guitar infomercial on it.
So it's thought, it's Stephen Steph?
Stephen Strahm, S-T-R-A-H-M.
Okay. So our listeners can go out on the internet, check that out. I'm sure they cost a couple bucks. And,
they do, but actually what I tell people, because he builds them all by hand. He only builds one instrument at a time. I met him because he was at Santa Cruz Guitar Company, and I have a Santa Cruz that I love, and he was great. He had done a lot on my Santa Cruz guitar, and then he, you know, just wanted to be creative and branch out on his own. I mean, he's still, you know, buddies with everybody there. So because he's kind of getting started, what I always tell people is that you're not going to get a better guitar for this, for what he's charging right now. And it's not going to, you know, things are going to change really fast. He's been getting a ton of great reviews and a lot of nods from people who know what they're talking about. Right. And
complete handmade instruments have a tendency to.
Yeah. But, and his are great. I mean, I tend to be a little bit more in terms of a fan of the hard sciences, but I also do believe that when a good person throws their all into quality work, it's palpable.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I think so. Yeah, most of the time. Yeah, and the thing is, it sounds like that you were able to show an example of his instrument that was maybe outside of what he envisioned it as, you know, like it's something that he didn't even know or thought it would be capable enough of, you know, which is, it's awesome when somebody builds something and then somebody says, hey, did you know it could do this too?
Exactly.
You know, that's a ringing endorsement.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
That's a cool point. I like that.
Yeah, well, it sounded like he was surprised when you said you were going to do what you were going to do with his instrument, because you probably hadn't imagined someone doing that with his instrument. So that's, you know, it just shows the versatility of something that's really well made, you know.
And it's incredibly well made. In fact, I kind of feel like he blew the notion out of the water that a great sounding steel string has to be, you know, masochistic to play. It actually plays really nicely. And in fact, little bit of trivia, he is one of he is in the Minor Swing video. There are two guys playing cards at a table. One of them is Thomas Perry, the drummer for Abandon All Hope, and the other one is Stephen Strahm, the guy who built the guitar.
Wow.
Very nice.
Look at that.
Trivia, folks.
Yeah. Now, the nylon classical guitar that you're playing on your album, where is – tell us about that.
That's a Kenny Hill Ruck classical guitar. It's definitely more guitar than I deserve, but I have it, so so now,
well, I don't know, after listening to what I just heard, I don't know about that statement.
Yeah,
no, it's definitely a guitar for a true classical guitar player. And even though I had you know, a marvelous teacher, and you know, still try to do, you know, put some time into it, I definitely feel a bit unworthy, but it's an absolutely wonderful instrument.
It's very good. When did you get that?
I got that maybe 2008, you know, 2009.
Wow.
I don't know exactly. I'm bad with knowing years.
Timelines aren't my thing either.
No. Just, somebody asked me something that happened 12 years ago, and I go, it was like last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. more than 5 years ago, fewer than 10 years ago.
Well, there you go.
You should be very familiar with it, and it should be very broken in by now.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's an awesome piece by now.
Mm. Yeah, it's a wonderful instrument.
They do just get better.
And,
you know, the more you play an instrument, the better it gets.
One of the cats, when you check out her Instagram, one of the cats, every time she plays, is like, hey, how about a pet? Pet me.
But you know what? Both of them, and as a matter of fact, Ferdinand is on my lap as we speak.
Well, there we
go. And there was actually a video interview I did on Skype with Rod DeGeorge, where both of the cats the entire time are just all over me. And because it's like a Skype interview, I just look like this crazy cat lady. And
well,
I'm like, you guys, come on, just give me an hour. Like, really?
No, we'll give you an hour after you're done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like, exactly.
Oh, you're
then
done
we'll
now?
Ignore
and you can pay attention to us now? Yeah, we don't
care.
Yeah,
we're done with you.
Yeah, we're done with you. Exactly.
Who are you? Why are you in our house?
Well, if you're in the house, where's the
food?
We're
not hungry.
Right. The electric stuff on the album, because around cut four or five, it it starts to starts to get substantially electric. What was the gear, and how did you record that? Was it, did you move air? Was it virtual? What were you doing?
Okay, so the main guitar that I used through the album was my Music Man Silhouette Special, the white one that normally, you know, you see, you know, that I have in pictures and stuff. There were three, where I used my Les Paul. I used it for, I think, just the rhythm parts on Shadows. Okay. And then I used it for Hound of Hades and for Beast. What I did, because an album like this can easily, it can cost as much money as you have and then some. And so I was trying to be very cost conscious while also doing, wanting the album to sound as good as possible. So what I did is I set up my Engel amp in my garage and just ran, you know, a mic in front of it, and plugged it into my just little laptop Pro Tools thing. But I split the signal, so I got a direct line as well. And so I was able to record the takes with a tone that was pretty similar to what I envisioned the tone would be on the final album. So I got the takes at home, and then I went to Get Real Productions, which is the studio in San Francisco where I recorded pretty much all of Hail Souls. And then I reamped the takes from the direct signal.
Yeah,
and I just sort of brought all of my amps and... What's really cool about reamping, actually, is that you can be in total guitar player mode when you're tracking, right? You can get a tone that's close to what you're going for, but is, you know, is comfortable, it sounds good at whatever volume you're playing, and you just kind of play your parts the best you can. And then by reamping, you go in the studio, and you don't even have your guitar with you. You basically just have the tracks, you have different tones, and you're totally in producer mindset. So you're not thinking like, hey, I need a little bit more gain, this might ring out a little bit nicer. You're actually thinking, how does this sound with a string quartet? You know, how is this sitting with the drums and bass? And so a lot of times the tone that you end up going with is maybe a little further away from where you imagined it was going to be. But what I ended up doing, I have a Turok Bionics that I love, that has become my main amp for Zeppelella. I have my Engel Special Edition 670 that has EL34s. I used my Fender. I have a 66 Deluxe Reverb, and that was actually the only track that I didn't reamp was Limbo. Huh. I did that all just in the studio with my Fender, and then I have my Marshall, a 1977 JMP, and what I just did is I just ran the tracks through all of them, listened to how they sat in the mix, and then made my decision from there. And I think without fail, I ended up going with the Engel for almost everything. Not any favoritism for what all of the other ones do so well. I mean, I own them, so clearly I love them and I play them, but for the particular ensemble, for the way it was blending with everything else, the Engel was just hitting the spot for me. So,
yeah, and it's just so nice to have that freedom to, you know, to, like you said, track in guitar mode, but then go back in producer mode, as you said, and actually have the freedom to have a track that feels like you're in guitar mode, but then to be able to select what fits the best, you know, and not have to worry about retracking or...
Yeah.
The amp that I tracked with isn't sitting right.
Well, it's sort of like Amplitube, but it weighs a lot more.
It's real. It's exactly. Real, Mick. It's real. But yeah, it's so nice to have that ability to be able to reamp nowadays.
I cannot imagine. Maybe you guys can tell me. why anybody, even if you're in a studio tracking and you are totally sure you've got your sound dialed in, why not just get a direct line as well? Right? You know, say you get the most magical take of your life. It has the mojo. It has everything you wanted. And then suddenly you're like, oh man, if, you know, if I had just done a little bit less gain, maybe the dynamics would be a little bit, you know, then you're not in that position because you really can. You can have that exact magical take and you can just dial things a little bit more and be able to do it from the amp. I mean, I know there's lots you can do after the fact, but it just opens up a lot of options. And actually, something I did quite a bit on Hail Souls, I didn't do as much on this album actually, is what I would do is I would run the exact same take through two different amps. And so like I would have the angle just screamingly, you know, loud and distorted, but then I'd also run a track through the Fender. And so sometimes that would give you really nice clarity while also having like the really big sounding guitars too.
That's been done a lot mm-hmm. of guys, you know, do that. Definitely mm-hmm. use two amps even live, you know. One is for just the girth and the balls and the overdrive, mm-hmm. and the other one is for the articulation, which you lose if you have too much of the other,
because of all the compression compression that happens with high gain and you know, all that, it notes kind of sometimes round off, you don't even hear them, where you have that amp that's a little bit cleaner, and all of a sudden it pops more because you're getting that cool spectrum, you know. Now the other thing that is neat about this new album, and obviously whoever did you in you didn't engineer the whole thing, obviously the strings were engineered over in Italy, but you were somebody engineered it over here.
I was there
for
most of it. There were three tracks where the first violin I wasn't there for, but the rest of it I was there.
Because the thing that is very unique about this album in this day and time is it's not the brick wall nightmare. And we've had this conversation, Jeff, where if you listen to any modern day band, there's no dynamics.
Oh, yeah.
Not absolutely. That there's no dynamics in the band, but the way that it's recorded, it's literally compress it down and then limit it back up. So it's all just the same exact volume.
No matter what's happening, it's all the same level.
And that doesn't work with the string stuff. And I think that's why I when I listen to some of that stuff, especially with the strings, I get that feeling like this is an old piece of music because it has such a dynamic range.
Yeah, there's one question that I forgot to ask before. Mm-hmm. You said you actually dumped to tape at one point. At what part of the process did you do that? Was it after the final mix? How did that play out?
In a lot of cases, it was after the final mix. And sometimes we ended up doing it twice. Sometimes we would bounce the individual tracks to tape and then the final mix. So it was different. You know what? Gosh, and I should have been more diligent about taking notes. I'm sure I have it all in emails, because a lot of times we would audition different things. Sometimes we would bounce something to tape and we'd be like, actually, that doesn't sound better. Or, hey, maybe you needed it a little bit higher or lower volume so the bounce sounds better, because that can make such a huge difference too. So I think all of the final mixes were bounced to tape, and I think some of the strings were also bounced to tape at some point in the process too.
So was the master tape, or is the master digital?
The master's digital, because Ugo, who did he did the mixes and the masters.
Okay.
So the mix is okay.
I believe so. You know, and that was the thing. I was doing that part remotely. You know, the mixing. I don't know. I was actually there for one, couple of day chunk, in the summer last year. But most of that stuff he was kind of doing, and then just would send stuff off, and I would give notes on it.
Wow. You know, interesting. Even with all the technology that we have nowadays. It, like tape simulation and everything else.
Yeah,
it's still just better if you bounce it to a piece of analog tape.
It's that analog voice. You know, that analog voice a lot of times wins because, you know, it cleans it up too much. You know, or it separates. You know, the audio bandwidth, even though you can run it now at 96.
Oh, you mean the digital thing?
Yeah, right. You know, And I mean, obviously it's going to get wider and wider, you know, with the bandwidth, but it's still, there's something
it
there.
That mean it gets better and better.
That is true. Yeah. Right. Sometimes, I mean, it's too clear, you know, and when you make it too clear, your ears kind of look at it and go, you know,
no, I mean, there's compression that happens on the tape. There's compression that happens from the machine and how hot you track it.
Yeah.
And it's, there's just something that's still more real about that than when they try to emulate it with ones and zeros. You know, there's still something that's not 100%.
And
right.
And
I like that.
We've said this a billion times. I mean, they can reinvent, you know, guitar amps and put more distortion into them and everything else. But there is that kind of, you know, what did we say? Three amps, the, you know, the Fender, the Vox, and the Marshalls that kind of made, they kind of hit it, you know, the first time
they got
out.
It right. Yeah.
Yeah.
They got it right.
And it was like, oh, well, that's what works, you know, and there's been variations and, you know, of course we have East Amplification right here next to me, but it's kind of like you can't rewrite that formula. And going to this digital world, it sometimes it doesn't come across the same way, even though it's honestly even clearer than what you can get through tape. And sometimes the clarity is not where you need to be. That weird way.
We're still old dinosaurs, you know. But that's okay. I'll stick with it. It's fine. No, yeah. Everything has its place. Everything has its place. I was a little surprised when you said you had dumped a tape, you know, during the process here and there, which I thought was really cool and maybe not as unique as we might think it is, but you know, at some point somebody thought, "Hey, this could make it better." And then you did it, you know, and sometimes it did, maybe sometimes it didn't, but it's still cool to have, you know, to be able to do that. God, one of these days when they stop making analog tape, that's going to be bad. That's going to be bad. There are studios out there now that specialize in repurposing.
Yeah.
Because it's so expensive.
Davey Knowles used to repurpose tape.
That's right.
In Chicago. Yeah. And he says there's only like a 2% degrading of the tape by doing that. So he said, yeah, because it's much cheaper than buying the new. So you obviously spent a chunk of money making this album, I take it.
Well, you know, I didn't have a budget in my mind. I didn't worry too much about it. I just did everything the best I could for as little money as possible.
Wow.
And everybody who was involved was really generous with their time and their efforts. You know, I didn't ask anybody to do anything for free. I wouldn't do that. But that was another part of why it took a long time. You know, I didn't have just like money burning a hole in my pocket.
Unlimited.
I'm a guitar player.
Budgets,
like,
yeah,
I don't,
right?
I'm not independently wealthy, you know? So, but, you know, and that's why doing a lot of stuff at home and actually having the parts composed ahead of time made things a lot more clear. You know, when you can give a string quartet, you know, a thoroughly looked at score. And even if that means like paying my composition teacher to look it over, it's like, well, an hour of her time is a heck of a lot cheaper than an hour of studio time plus the time for a string quartet.
Sure.
You know, so I just tried to have my stuff as dialed in as possible going into it and to have a really clear idea of what I wanted so that I'd be, you know, there were a couple little mishaps here and there, but in general, if something wasn't working, I was really quick to speak up and to try to get things moving in the direction that I wanted them so that we didn't waste time and then therefore money.
Right. You know, there are some things that can be written on the fly and spontaneously in the studio. This ain't one of them.
You know what? There is one part that was, though.
Really?
At the very end of Limbo, you have this kind of chorus of Kirstens that come in.
Yeah, we heard her in there. I was like, that's got to be her sister.
Yeah, that's Kirsten. That's her on Limbo, on Shadows,
she's
on
cheap.
Grace.
She's cheap to hire when you're related to her.
She is cheap. Yeah, it's incredible. But what she did is she was sounding so good that in the studio, I was like, maybe I'm just going to write like a vocal harmony here. And so I would like write it really quick and then hand it to her and she'd do it. And then two sounded great. So I think we ended up doing like four tracks of her.
Wow.
So it starts off with like one and then it becomes like two. And then at the very end, I think it goes to four tracks of vocal. That was done in the studio, like with me truly just like scribbling it down and then handing it to her and her just, you know, I remember she had a cold one of the days that we tracked. And so we ended up just giving her more and more booze to kind of loosen up her throat. And so she was getting, you know, she's a lightweight, you know, getting pretty tipsy and then singing this like angelic stuff.
Well, there you go.
That's pretty wild. That's pretty wild.
But for the most part, you're absolutely right, which is no, there was not much improvising going on in the studio. The most freedom was given to Tom, the drummer, because even though I did write parts, you know, I wrote skeletal parts saying like, hey, I'm a guitar player. Yes, I'm studying composition. No, I'm not going to write every single hit for you. But here's like the basic structure, you know, it would be like, kick, snare, toms is what I wrote, you know, but I was like, you figure out your cymbal hits, you figure out the hi-hat, and if something seems stupid, tell me, you know? So, but normally, I mean, one of the things I love so much about working with Tom Perry is that he is so musical, and he has such a wonderful tone and a wonderful ability to be both technical and also very human, like very musical. You know, he doesn't sound like a machine, but he also nails stuff too. And I'm a guitar player who loves drums. Like, you know, I was listening to some mixes a friend of mine sent me, you know, and they were thinking the drums were too loud. And I was like, I don't know. I'd go louder actually. You know, I play in a Zeppelin band. My God, I like drums. I like big drums.
What? How many guitars do you have in your arsenal?
I've got like 13.
13.
Yeah, but keeping in mind that I play electric guitar, steel string, and classical, right?
Well, you got to count them all. Of course.
You want me to count them?
No, for you? Okay. You have to include them all.
Yes.
Okay. Because you play. Let me see. Right. So I have, my first guitar ever was a Music Man Silhouette. That's the one that's in the Valentino's Victory Lap video. And I love that guitar, and I'm always kind of nervous about taking it out just because they're, to be honest, I don't really have a lot of deep emotional bonds with my instruments. Not because I don't really like them, but because they're tools. Like, I don't want to, like, if I can't play it, then they're of no use to me. And so I want them to be practical tools. I don't see the need in getting overly precious about it if I can help it. But my first guitar is my first guitar. So that's the one that I have definitely a very sentimental attachment to. And then my second one was kind of its fraternal twin, Silhouette Special. And then I have my classical guitar, the Kenny Hill Rock. I have an SG, two Les Pauls. I didn't think I was going to get a second one, but it was when, oh yeah, and Daniele hates me for this forever. It was when Zev Perella opened for Kiss. Not with Ace, but we opened for Kiss, and I realized, you know what, when you play a show like that, that's, you know, it's not like that's our typical gig, but we did play it, and I realized that if I broke a string, I was going to be finishing the set on my Music Man Silhouette. Mm-hmm. And you know how much I love my Silhouette, but that was a terrifying prospect for me. And that's when I'm like, you know, I've been in this band for long enough. Do you think, you know, it started to feel unprofessional for me not to have a true, solid, feasible backup guitar. So I have a second Les Paul that I keep in Dadgad for Cashmere.
Is that the blue one?
Yeah.
Okay. So the one that you play all the time is a like a lemon sunburst or whatever they
call
it.
It's like a cherry sunburst. Cherry. Yeah.
Okay. So you got two Les Pauls, and then mm-hmm. goes from there.
Dan Electro.
Of course.
As you guys, mm-hmm. as I have often put my foot in my mouth on my last show with you guys. My Dan Electro that is a special and unique instrument.
What is it? The shittiest, best... What did you say? What was it that you said?
I think I said it was the best shitty guitar out there.
There it is.
But I mean, it's like good and not raunchy. Like, anyway.
It is. I mean, it was good enough for Paige, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. I mean, it's, you know,
Jimmy
it
was
doesn't
high,
have that polish.
He was high on heroin a lot, so we got to make sure. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, he was. My God, I can't even think about, like, I can barely construct a sentence if I've had a drink and a half. Like, how he played shows, like, on that stuff is really admirable.
Yeah. That was most of the bands in the 60s.
For sure. Right.
Okay, and then for the other guitars, I have my two acoustics, the Santa Cruz and the Steven Strom. Okay. I have a Sadowski Nylon String Electric, and I have a Music Man Majesty. Oh. Did you count What is that? Is that like
I didn't count.
I didn't.
I think it's about 13.
Okay.
Somewhere around.
I like the Sadowski. That's very cool.
Yeah.
I love the Sadowski. That was like, there have been two guitars. One was the Stephen Strom and one was the Sadowski, where I was in no way, shape, or form in the market for it. It wasn't a guitar I needed. It wasn't something like, yet every other guitar I've gotten because I needed to get it. Either that or they were gifts. Some of my guitars have been things that I inherited somehow. So my Sadowski was, Roger had contacted me and was like, look, I don't want to step on any toes. I know you've got a longstanding relationship with Ernie Ball, but you know, would you care to try out one of my guitars? And, you know, I was like, yeah, I definitely am not wanting to step on any toes either, but sure, I'll try something out. And so I looked on his website and saw this nylon string electric, and I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting, you know? And I kind of thought about how, like, Steve Morse has this kind of electric classical guitar. I think mm-hmm. it's a Buscarino. Is that right? Did I make that up?
I don't know. I can't know them all.
To me, you guys know everything about gear, so I figured you would know. But, so he sent me this guitar to try out, and I immediately started. I saw that you could play classical stuff on it because it's got the wider nut width. Nice. and the nylon strings. But there was that total convenience of just being able to plug it in.
Yeah.
And not only that, but because you could also play it with a pick in a way that really doesn't feel comfortable or even, you know, anything less than heresy on a on a regular classical guitar. I started playing things that I never would have played, and that's when it kind of occurred to me that I'm like, look, if an instrument immediately presents a new creative direction or dimension to you, that's the type of instrument you should get. It's a creative tool at that point. It isn't just like another guitar to sit around and look pretty or to have to house. You know, I don't like having excess stuff. And I actually feel guilty about having guitars that I don't play. But, you know, I can't get rid of my SG. Like, that was my Angus guitar. I love it forever.
Absolutely.
Even though I haven't played it in a long time.
What year is that? Do you know?
Oh, yeah. It's nothing special. It's like, it was one of the custom shops, but I got it at the local music store Gelb Music. Mm-hmm. It was on like super, super sale, and so I got a really good deal on it. But it was the 61 Les Paul reissues.
Okay.
Nice. So,
and it's
so
a, is it really black nice. Or is it red?
It's kind of this like, it's like a dark brown red. It's not like one I've seen a lot.
Okay. I think they call that the heritage red or something like that.
Yeah, maybe, but it isn't the cherry one that's like a lot more red. This one's like much browner.
Well, you can't take this out on the road, are you, or are you?
What?
Your new album.
I was just going to say.
Oh, this one? It certainly would mean a lot more budget than I currently have. I wouldn't do it. You know, I know a lot of guitar players like will very effectively do stuff to backing tracks, but I feel like that completely would encourage people to hear the album in the wrong way. I didn't write it to be a guitar album. Like, obviously there's guitar on it, and some of the parts were certainly required some woodshedding on my part. So, you know, it's got its moments, but it's like, it'd be silly. It'd be like taking one person out of any larger ensemble and having them play to backing tracks. It's like, it's all about the interactions of the instruments. So to get a guitar, bass, drums, piano, keys, vocal, string quartet, you know, that's a significant amount of budget that I don't have, not to mention the amount of rehearsal that would be required. Oh, I mean, the people who are on the album, not the least of whom, Salome Scheidegger, the piano player, she was playing with the Zurich Symphony Orchestra when she was like 16 years old. She's amazing.
Oh my God.
You know, so it's like these people who were playing on the album were just, you know, I couldn't believe that I was getting the kind of talent I was on the album. I was just, it was like a dream come true. And yet anybody, like, people got to live, people got to get paid. And, you know, unless something happens with this album or somewhere else in my life that things change financially a lot, I don't want to say I wouldn't do it. I would love to do it, but I would only love to, I would do it if I could do it right.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, if you got your sister liquored up enough, you'd have her on board, so that'd be no problem.
It's true. And actually, she did the keys parts. Salome did the piano. So I got one musician who will do two parts, you know, for Blanton's bourbon. So
Nice.
Well, there's a good note to end on.
Well, at least she doesn't drink cheap.
Lynn's is pretty good. It's pretty good bang for the buck.
It is. It is. And you get the little horse. You know,
so. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Nice. Giving this to my nephew. You know, he'll look back and be like, "Ah, oh, it's my weird aunt." Yeah.
She went through another bottle.
She had
right, exactly.
She had a drinking problem.
No problem. She could drink all the time.
That's beautiful.
Awesome. All right. Anything else that you can think of that we haven't covered, Gretchen?
Let's see what other embarrassing things have happened that we didn't talk about. I don't know. I mean, it's just always such a pleasure to talk with you guys. And I so appreciate you listening to the album and, you know, your thoughtful comments on it and everything.
Oh, it's all good. It's all good.
I know one thing I meant to say. I want to make sure I emphasize how much Michael Melendez and Max Crace were just absolutely indispensable parts of this project. I mean, I know that a lot of people get stuff on iTunes, mm-hmm. and that's great. It's available on iTunes, but this album was always intended to be a concept album. So the libretto that goes along with it that Mike Melendez wrote is completely, I mean, it's not only important, it's like why the album came about was because of his concept. And the images that Max Crace created to accompany the whole thing are just staggeringly beautiful. So I do encourage anybody who might be interested in checking it out to, if you download it through my website, if you don't want to like get the physical copy, the download comes with the images and the and the libretto too. But yeah, so throughout the whole process, not just providing the concept, but through, you know, some of his feedback on like the final mixes and everything were just really helped get things more cinematic sounding. And, you know, Max's entire vision of the whole thing was just amazing.
So it is available as a physical copy as well.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Which get you know, on dinosaurs like me prefer. You know,
and can we get
well,
that?
Well, I would be happy to send you one.
Oh, no. I'm not begging for one. No. I have it downloaded. Thank you very much. But it's always nice when it's available. You know, in a tangible.
Can you get that through Amazon?
No, I hate to say it, but the reason not is that Amazon just, they decide what price it is. And my album is like almost double length. So it is priced a little bit more than, you know, the $9.99. I think it's like $12.99 or I can't remember
what I paid. I paid something like that.
But, you know, I mean.
Thank you. It's so nice.
Whatever. You know.
People buy music.
Yes.
Jesus, it's not that expensive. And, you know, musicians have to make a living. Buy the music.
I love buying music. And I don't know if we talked about this last time. Did we talk about my hunch about the psychology of buying stuff?
No.
Is that you're invested in it. You experience something differently. Truly, if you pay for something, you experience it differently. It's because you've taken the first step to investing. I mean, that's basically you saying, I am betting $10 or $15 or $20. One, I'm getting the efforts of someone's lifetime for like less than $20, which is pretty awesome. You know, you're not going to find any better bang for the buck than books and music.
Right.
But you've also engaged that much with whatever it is you're doing. And on some level, whether or not you really think about it, you do know that you're supporting something. And I actively like shelling out $10 for an album or whatever it is. I find that I listen to it differently. I engage with it differently. It becomes not something that someone's like, oh, this person wants me to listen to their album. I guess I'll check it out because I have to. Versus I am choosing to engage with and experience somebody's creative or artistic offering.
You know, I really like I like that thought. And I think maybe to take it one step further, I think it becomes far less disposable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like if you get it for free, you don't care about it. It can come and go. You really pay no attention to it. Yeah. It just flows. It comes in and out of your life like it didn't exist. But
people don't think twice about spending $10 on a burrito out here, at least, you know. And if you think about like how much an artist spends on an album, any album, it doesn't have to be an album of the magnitude of Abandon All Hope. You know, even the simplest, rawest, you know, single instrument album, that is countless hours of composition, of practice, of, you know, sure. studio time, all of that. And it's like, you get that for 10 or 15 bucks. Are you kidding me? That's like the deal of a century. And totally. Not only just supporting it and being part of trying to keep afloat an industry that isn't in a good time. You know, the right. way I see it is that we've gone from, you know, a time that really predated my ever being in music when things were really thriving and it was really saturated. We've gone to a time where every single person who's doing music, I think, maybe with a few exceptions, are they're not doing it for fame and fortune, because you don't get fame and fortune now in music right. with very rare exceptions. People are doing it for the right reasons. People are doing it because they're wanting to make art. And so by supporting that, you're supporting the community that you're part of. And that's why I actually have homework for myself. If I don't buy an album like at least once a month, like I start to feel like, oh, I better figure out what album I'm going to buy this month. You know, that is what I can do to help other artists to try to keep an industry that isn't thriving right now going.
Yeah, for yeah. sure. That's a great commitment to have, and you're absolutely right about it.
I've taken a thing on that if I hear a single and I like it, I just buy the album.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. I know that single isn't going to do it, but mm-hmm. buying the album
will help.
Can throw sure. a lot more at them. And you know, even there's going to be some stinkers, you mm-hmm. know, depending.
That's okay.
But it's fine. And sometimes you go, hey, it ain't so bad after the fifth time you've heard it.
Yeah.
You know?
I like it better now than the first time I heard it.
A lot of stuff has to grow on you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, that, yeah, totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, some of my favorite stuff isn't stuff that necessarily grabbed me on the first listening.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And, you know, if you think about it, we're different people from who we were an hour ago on some small level, right? And what happens in a year or 5 years or whatever, it's like, I still think about when I got struck by Jeff Beck, when I got it. And I had had his albums from very early on when my dad was like, oh, you like Jimmy Page? You should check out Jeff Beck. And I had the albums and I listened to them and I tried to like them, you know, but, and there was some stuff that kind of grabbed me more, but I always say that I was post Mutt Lange era production ears, you know, so some of the older Jeff Beck stuff, it just didn't have that clarity and that saturation that had become expected by the time I, you know, started listening to music. And it wasn't until I saw Jeff Beck live that it was like getting hit by a freight train. And then I was able to go back and listen to Blow by Blow and There and Back and stuff like that and really appreciate it without being so superficial as to have something as like the production stand in my way.
Right.
But
right.
you never know. I was really glad I had those albums then, even though I hadn't been listening to them.
Well, you know, I was going to say, you can, what could happen 5 years, you know, from now, you'll go back to that CD that you bought with your own money
yeah.
and open it up and put it back on, you know, and hear mm-hmm. it with some fresh ears.
And
you know,
all of a sudden things happen.
And maybe relook at liner notes and things yeah. like that. And, you know, you see some things about some people that you were unfamiliar with 5 years ago, but now it's like, oh, this guy was on here, mm-hmm. you know, and
yeah.
that's where this guy came from. And, you know, it's just so good to have the tangible to look at. It's like when we used to have albums, you know, the liners that came out. And you know,
oh, yeah, thought, man.
You know, there was so much information there. It was mm-hmm. great.
Yeah,
you know,
it
and album sales are coming back, you know, not to where they used to be, but they're coming back strong.
Oh, yeah.
They really are. It's great.
I've noticed that people are really starting to understand that they vote with their dollar creatively. And I've had some just incredibly beautiful emails from people that I was kind of just bowled over by. And people who really do realize, like, I want this artist to continue to do stuff. I will buy their merch. You know, mm-hmm. I will go on their website and I will order this. And it's great. I mean, it's great that people are starting to recognize that connection.
That's yeah. awesome. I'm glad you're seeing that. I'm glad you're seeing that. Yeah,
that's why I'm broke, because I've done it, you know, a hundred and some odd thousand, a hundred and some odd times now.
Right.
And
right.
going, aww. Hey, you guys had six albums.
Okay. Can you slow down on the album?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
The one bonus I'll say about shipping your own albums is it's kind of a pain in the butt, actually, you know? And so you realize that either way it ends up being good. So like if I get a lot of orders in a week, I'm like, oh, great, I got a lot of orders in a week. And then I sit there and kind of, because I sign all of the CDs, I do a little handwritten note to everybody.
Oh, wow.
And so it takes me a minute to do it. You know, sometimes a lot of minutes to do it. But that's when I realized, I'm like, God, you know what? It's just like the same thing as loading your own gear. It's like doing things for yourself. It keeps you really connected with what you're doing. And you end up seeing both sides of it, which it's like, okay, rather than sit there and bemoan a slow week of website orders, I'd be like, cool, I don't have to go to the post office. And so in a way, it's like, it's a win-win situation. Of course, I would much rather people order my CD. But at the same time, when you're shipping them yourself, you realize that, okay, you see the good and the bad with everything, and gives you just a wider worldview.
Well, it's cool. Seems like you can see the good side of either or, so that's awesome. Yeah. That's a great way. That's a great outlook to have. Well, cool. I hope after our listeners listen to this show,
they will check it out and
purchase said new CD that you will sign for them and take to the post office yourself.
And as a guitar player, you will be broadening your horizons there.
Because, by buying this? Yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Because it's not the stuff that I produce type.
Nor I. Well, cool. Well,
you're scratching your head for an hour going, how in the hell did she write this?
Only you can do your music, so you need to do your music, because
there's only one
of you in all of time.
There you see. She's finding the positive there.
Oh, there's one real quick thing.
Okay.
Real quick.
Okay.
You just did a little Bandcamp thing for Deep Purple stuff, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I totally forgot to mention that. That was so much fun. Like, I didn't know what to expect at all.
Yeah.
And it was a rock and roll fantasy camp, and it was with Deep Purple. And basically, I was hired as a counselor, and I got to teach alongside other counselors like Elliot Easton and Gary Hoey. You guys are Gary Hoey, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And Joel Hoekstra and Steve Brown from Trickster. Vinny Appice and Tony Franklin and...
Wasn't Steve there? Steve Morris?
So he wasn't one of the counselors. He's one of the, they call him the headliners. So yeah, Steve was there for a day. Glenn Hughes and... it was crazy.
Can you believe this lineup?
I felt so bad for the people who were stuck being like my students, because I was like, they're there with me, like, Elliot Easton from the Cars is going to be teaching me. I'm like, no, Gretchen from Zeppelin. Sorry about that, you know? But they were really cool. There was actually even a guy who apparently requested to be in my group, which kind of blew me away. But but it was really fun. I learned a ton. I was unquestionably the snot-nosed kid sister. I mean, it's like having to take a solo after Joel Hoekstra. Do you want to talk about like what embarrassing is? That is what embarrassing is for
me. But did he do his with all eight fingers? Come on.
Yes, of course he did. And he's like 6'5". And he looked like, if you were to draw a picture of a rock star, that's what you draw. And he's got his gold top Les Paul, and he's got the poses, and he's got the tone, and he's got the technique. And then it's like, okay, Gretchen, take a solo. I'm like, no, actually, I'm just going to go shoot myself in the face. Actually, that's what's going to happen now. And Steve Brown, too. I mean, these were guys who were in my counselor group. So I didn't have to solo after Gary Hoey or anything like that. They weren't in my group. It was... that's why I'm singling out these other two. But the positive thing is I ended up learning a lot and realizing some different ways to work in my weak areas. But boy, did I come away. I felt like my tail was tucked so far between my legs that it was like going up my nose. I just felt, but everybody was super cool. And it was awesome. Really, really fun. And getting to watch my campers play with Highway Star with Steve Morris was pretty cool. Like, I had two guitar players in the band, so they worked out the harmony, and it was really, really fun.
Nice.
And all of the counselors were just like superlatively nice.
Can you believe that?
That's really great. Cool guys.
That's great.
Jamming with Steve Morris and Gretchen Menn's your teacher.
Well, what was so funny is my students decided they wanted to take the guitar solo, and they made it clear at the camp that the campers, you know, we're here to make them feel like rock stars, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, all right, so what's Steve going to do? And they're like, oh, he can take the organ solo. So, you know, we get to the stage where they're going to jam with Steve, and they want me to get on stage too. And I'm like, well, let's see. The stage is tiny. We have two drummers in the band. And in Deep Purple, there is one guitar player. So you're wanting four guitar players on stage. And I'm like, yeah, I'd love to be up there doing that for my own selfish reasons, but I'm not going to do that. There's no reason for that. It's not going to add anything. But my campers just turned to Steve. They're like, okay, you're taking the organ solo. And he's like, oh okay.
Jesus. Now go learn.
I'm bossing him around.
Well, you know,
I don't know the organ solo.
The little unknown secret or known secret is Steve has been the guitar player in Deep Purple longer than anybody else.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
How about that?
Yeah.
So was Glenn in the same band?
They came different days. So the first, the camp started Thursday. Steve came Friday. Ian, I had always thought it was heard. I always heard it pronounced Ian Pace, but then I thought Steve said Pisces. So now I'm self-conscious about how to pronounce it. Ian, Deep Purple's drummer, whose last name I'm not sure how to pronounce. He came on Saturday, and then Glenn Hughes came on Sunday, which is the last day.
Wow.
Wow. Mm. Wow is right. Jesus. And then you just played with Tracy Guns the other day.
Oh, my God. Yes, I did. And talk about... Have you guys interviewed him? He's like the nicest dude ever.
We have not interviewed him.
Yeah, we definitely have to get Tracy. Yeah, we have
to. I'll just keep naming names. Tracy is so cool. Oh, my God. Like, I was serious. I felt like a teenager. Like, he's got the true rock star combination with, like, some serious chops. Some... like awesome mojo and that joyful performance, plus just being like the coolest dude you'll ever meet. Nice. So that was unbelievably cool. And he said come on up and sit in for a song. And I didn't really take it all that seriously, just because I'm like, I'd never met him before. Like, we just kind of knew each other through Instagram. And it's funny because the first time I think he tagged me or followed me or something like that, I just was like, oh, it's another rock star trying to build his following, like, you know, just following other guitar players, whatever. and then he ended up tagging me in a picture of a theremin. I was like, oh, what's going on with this? And so we ended up kind of just interacting over Instagram, and then he was going to be at the same venue where Zeppelin had played 2 weeks prior. And I was like, yeah, come on up, sit in for a song.
Cool.
I was like, really? So I learned the song. Danielle did too. And again, not really expecting anything. Like, there's a part of me that felt kind of like presumptuous putting my guitar in the car, even though he had made it very clear, like, please come sit in. Next thing I knew, we were sitting in. I was actually had me sound check his theremin for him. So I was like, really?
And now, never played one of these before.
Now I have one more name. Yeah.
Okay.
And then we can be done.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Lita Ford, you got the jam with her Nita Strauss and.
Oh yeah, a few more names actually. No, yeah. that was awesome. First of all, I mean, you guys know I love Nita Strauss. She is just like the nicest person and like Tracy Guns, just like the great combination of, you know, chops, you know, mojo, like great performer too, and just such a nice person. Like, I've rarely met somebody, Tracy's same way, but somebody in the industry who is so quick to give shouts out to other people. Like, some people are so, I don't know, guarded and jealous and, you know, Nita, just all she does all day long is say nice things about other people. Like, it's so cool. and then she's a badass on guitar. So I got to stand next to her, which was awesome. And we got to rock out together. We played the first song together and then also the last song. And that was also with, So from the other side of the stage, Neely Brosh, my good buddy. And then Yossi Hoffer and Steph Paynes from Led Zeppelin, who I'd never met her before. Yossi Hoffer and then Kat Dyson. And I don't think I'm forgetting anybody. Oh boy, I hope I'm not forgetting anybody. And then Lita. And it was just so fantastic. It's funny because, like, I tend not to fangirl out too much, but there was something, like, I didn't expect meeting Lita, just because, honestly, like, I wasn't somebody where, like, I had listened to every single album, was, like, you know, a diehard Lita fan. Like, I mean, I knew who she was, of course, like, who doesn't? But it wasn't until, like, a little bit before that I started, like, getting, you know, diving in deeper to the stuff, and also just realizing, like, what a huge debt of gratitude, like, any woman playing guitar nowadays owes Lita. Like, thinking about that, true. She was doing this 30 years ago when, boy, were things different. And,
Runaways.
You know, talk about kicking down some doors. So I didn't really get to, like, hang and chat with her, although I signed CDs next to her. And at one point, my sister surprised me and came through the line and had bought a CD. And so I wrote something like, super gross in hers, and Lita kind of like, because Lita was right next to me, she kind of looked over at me like, who are you and what are you doing? And I was like, no, that's my sister. And then she cracked up.
She's drunk right now, she won't know this. Wow. Well, yeah. we interviewed Nita, and I must say, her boyfriend Josh, who, you know, coordinated it through us, he has the Beverly Kills line. Definitely go check that out, because her whole motto is you know, ego kills, you know, the musician or the talent. Yes. And then of course, you know, just talking about being humble and everything. So she instills
stay
that.
Humble or be humble. Those are the two that I have, actually.
Yeah. Wow, nice. So there you go. So definitely check that out, because that line is doing really well, and it's all connected with Nita and everything. I mean, Nita,
not Lita.
I'll just get it right once.
Try being on a stage with Lita, Nita, and Neely, and not screwing it.
Well, there you go.
And now there's also Lari Basilio, who's a great guitar player, if you don't know her. But I was like, Lita, Nita,
Neely,
Lari. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, boy, this is, that was a tongue twister.
Too many leads.
Exactly. Wow. Cool. So I think we're done.
Unless
you're going to drop another name.
I don't have anything else, I don't think.
No, that was great. That was great. Yeah, well, Gretchen, thank you so much for taking so much time.
Yeah.
And best of luck with Abandon All Hope, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Best of luck with Abandon All Hope.
Thank you. Thank you so much, you guys. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you.
Open-minded enough to purchase it and give it a listen, even though it's not a hard rock thing or a Zeppelin kind of thing, or, you know, not even an AC/DC kind of thing. No. But it's something that is very creative, very good, and done extremely well.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish you the best of luck with it.
Yes.
Thank you so much. You guys are so awesome, and I always enjoy getting to chat with you, so... Thank you. And also, I love listening to your podcast with so many awesome guitar players who are either friends or inspirations or people I'm learning about and get to learn about through you guys. So thanks for doing such a great thing for music.
Well, thanks. Thank you. We learn a lot, too. We learn a lot, too.
Yeah, and don't take all this time to write the next album, you know?
Oh, my God. Actually, I have been composing all the while. So
there you go.
Hopefully, I will have learned something in the process, but... It's like you learn something and then you realize all the stuff you don't know, and then you just become more and more overwhelmed with all there is to learn.
I think the next album is going
to
be Appalachian folk songs or something.
There you go.
You know, just something completely different again.
Why not?
Yeah. Solo acoustic guitar. That's it.
That's it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah. The band's less expensive for sure.
You can take that out on the road.
Absolutely. All right, cool.
All right, Gretchen, thank you guys.
Thank you so much. Have a great rest of the day, and much
too.
Continued success.
Okay, thanks, you guys.
And there you have the story.
Yeah, man.
You know, wow. The album is very, like I just said, it's different, you know, for most people that listen to our podcast and the music that they listen to, I am assuming.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really good. It's done really well. Very imaginative. You know, it's a concept. It's a theme, you know.
Yeah.
Release.
And it conveys very well.
Yeah.
You know, I went in and I just figured, well, okay, I'm going to listen to this. I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm going to, you know, going to take a listen and just, because I listen to the Bonehead stuff, right? So I'm just going, well, I gotta, you know, hey, no, this is what we're gonna do. Right. So I listened to it and I was like, this isn't bad. I can listen to this and not, I don't, you know, it isn't like, classical music affects you differently than other musics. And I was like, you know what, man, this is done well.
It is.
Because, you know, like I said, some of it can be just a way over to the top, especially modern stuff. But this is not that way to me.
No, there. I mean, you know, go into it with a mind open to enjoy some classical, you know. And then it'll smack you in the face with some rock, you know? It's all good.
Oh, there's some ripping parts in there.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Let me tell you, for our progressive friends that like some off-time stuff, there's a couple songs on there that very, very neat, unique time signatures.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's very cool and very well done. And, that's a harder market to crack than any kind of rock or pop or anything like that, you know. Yeah. Just to take the time to compose it and the time and the expense to record it and to release it, you know, that's a lot of work on her part, you know.
And it was an ocean apart.
exactly. So I mean, you know, if you have an open mind to music, go out and buy it. I think you really enjoy it.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to have any problems, man.
No, not at all.
So until next time, my friend.
That's right, because you never know what we're going to unearth next.
That's right. I'm Mick Marcellino.
I'm Jeff Bober.
And we're always saying...
Onward.
Be sure and follow the show on Twitter, at Amps and Axes. Also, make sure you like the show on Facebook. For news, comments, and everything else, visit the webpage, ampsandaxescast.com. Thanks for listening.